The Serpentine Podcast. Time pass on work.
This is the Serpentine Podcast on work. I'm your host, Victoria Sin, joined as always by Lucia Pietro-Justi. For episode 6, we're dreaming.
I read that 80% of young professionals in New York City were working regularly from bed. So the boudoir, in a way, is defeating the office tower. Network technologies have removed any limit of what we can do in bed. The bed is now a site of action, and a whole new industry is devoted to providing contraptions to facilitate work while lying down, reading, writing, testing, recording, broadcasting, listening, talking, and of course, eating, drinking, sleeping, or making love, activities that seem to have been turned of late into work itself. Endless advice, as you know, is dispensed about how to work on your relationships today, how you are supposed to schedule sex with your partner, because otherwise apparently it doesn't happen. Sleeping is, of course, definitely hard work. Everything done in bed has become work.
That was Beatrice Colomina, the brilliant architecture historian, talking from the stage of the Royal Geographical Society at the recent Serpentine Work Marathon.
So, Victoria,
mm-hmm.
Do you schedule sex with your partner?
Oh, my God.
And hi. By the way, hi.
No, I do not. Not at the moment. But I have come close to that. I feel like it's maybe something that happens when you've been, with your partner for, a very, very long time. And you need to remind yourselves, you know, that you are sexual beings who are attracted to each other and, you know, enter the bedroom.
I mean, maybe, you know, does that happen also, like Beatrice says, because you schedule everything else, so you've got all this. But that's kind of scheduling by default, like the time that I have left, I shall spend having sex.
I guess so. I mean, maybe, I think it just, it's not that sexy to schedule sex, is it?
No.
It's supposed to be like spontaneous and, you know.
Right? Yeah, but for that you need a drink and some free time and not too much work to do. So spontaneity comes at a great amount of labor.
That's true. I mean, so maybe everything else, we should just schedule it.
Why not?
But I know a lot of people also just work from bed all the time. Like there's this kind of blurred distinction between a workplace and a bed.
Do you think working from bed or when you're working from bed, you think differently?
So this is exactly what Beatrice Colomina explored in this notion of the bed as the workplace at the Dutch Pavilion at this year's Venice Architecture Biennale. She restaged John Lennon and Yoko Ono's famous Hilton Hotel Bed Inn of 1969, where the bed became a 24-hour site of work and protest against the Vietnam War. Beatrice recreated her bed in at the Serpentine Marathon this year, but instead of being in the Hilton Hotel, like John and Yoko, she was in the only partially sheltered Serpentine Pavilion, which I experienced.
It was cold.
It was a little bit cold. She set up a bed in there and conducted interviews in public for hours, asking the interviewees to join her in pajamas. I jumped into bed with her.
Yes, in your pajamas.
Yes. I borrowed a robe that you lent me. Let's be honest.
That is true. I was in my pajamas.
Yes, you were in your pajamas all day and you looked fabulous.
But yeah, so the conversations were amazing. It was interesting because at the Venice Biennale, a lot of the conversations were by architects about architecture. So often they had to do with the space of the home or the space of the bed. Mm-hmm. And here, situating those same conversations in an art context, all of a sudden there was dreams that came up and domestic labor that came up and all these other ideas that perhaps hadn't figured quite as much.
Yeah.
And it was also interesting that in that context, then there was a kind of mutual, the architects were saying, oh, it's really great to be in the art world context because you're free from the idea of a brief of having to achieve a building or a space at the end of it. Mm. And the art world is constantly turning to architecture, particularly critical architecture, to go but how do we turn all the things that we want to do or make into praxis, policy, reality, all of this? So there was a kind of a love-in and the bed-in as well.
Hi.
This is very intimate.
It's totally intimate to be in the bed of a stranger.
Oh my God, it's like a kiss-a-thon or something.
Yes, a kiss-a-thon.
You guys have been so intense in the bed. Lots of thoughts, lots of cognitive thinking.
Yes, well, that was part of the idea. The idea is that a lot of cognitive thinking is happening now.
Yeah.
In bed, whether with another person, but mostly through our technical devices with people that are not actually in the same bed. But they are in the same bed in another way.
I'm Catherine Vega. You can call me Kate.
Kate.
And I'm an artist. I work with virtual reality, performance, poetry. But at the moment, I love dreaming. So I have just been at this archaeological conference, drawing the dreams of groups of people. So every night when they go to sleep, in the mornings when they wake up with their dream, they come and they report it in a group. And then I draw them all, and we listen to them all. You know, and this group dream work I do with an indigenous network, because many communities throughout time have really listened deeply to what comes in dream. I feel like we've lost that ability. We have lost that listening. And you know, the extraordinary thing is, no one, if you ask people, they're like, oh yes, I did dream, but I don't remember what it was. Stuff happened, you know.
Yeah.
But they do not. They don't carry it with them. If you keep on saying over a number of days, "Can you remember your dream?" Something comes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I should try that.
You must. Yes. But I want to ask you: do you have a dream?
Oh, I have a lot of dreams. I dream a lot. I mean, I don't make a very big distinction between dreaming and living, unlike a lot of the people that I have interviewed today. I feel like I'm living in a dream most of the time. And my dreams are also very much connected to what I do. I mean, most of the ideas I ever had, I had actually in the moment of falling asleep or in the moment of waking up. You know, how you can be working very hard on a project or writing, and it's not really very interesting, or it's interesting but you don't know how to express it. And all of a sudden, in this moment in which you are practically about to fall asleep, I think a lot of writers know that, the perfect clarity comes into your mind, and you say to yourself, I will remember it tomorrow, but you won't, right? So you have to kind of have a notebook near your bed and put some notes there.
You know, the interpenetration of reality and dream. The San Bushmen say there is a dream that's dreaming us. And maybe it is, you know, letting go of trying so hard and just letting the dream arise.
Yes, yes.
I feel like there's so much knowledge in the earth, in the landscapes, that when we let that, when we relax our minds, we just open to these symbols and images. It's like a language.
Yeah, I totally believe that. I think the most interesting, beautiful things that have happened, the ones that happened, who wrote this? And you technically you did, but you were in such a state that it is like somebody else have done it, right?
Definitely.
And when you enter this particular zone, it's not just you anymore.
So will you tell me one dream, just one dream that you can remember vividly?
That's very personal. I don't know about that. This is totally psychoanalytical war now, because the question of the dream does come into the 20th century, into our modern world through psychoanalysis. So, but you are investigating another culture of the dream, right?
And I guess making space to rethink what it might mean. Because if we are very guarded about our dreams, if we do not want to tell each other because it might give us away in some, you know, it might expose us, then this is one way of, well, respecting that there's lots of truth inside them tangled up. But maybe there is something we need to listen to together. And I find that when a group tells each other what they've been dreaming about, they are telling each other about their their fears, their mm-hmm. shadows, mm-hmm. their narcissisms, egocentricities, mm-hmm. and also the creative spark and mm-hmm. the hope, the doorway of potential that is opening.
So it's kind of a group therapy. They tell each other their dreams. It's not they are not telling you uh-huh. particularly.
Absolutely.
Because before you say, when you ask people to remember their dreams, mm-hmm. Something happens. But this group of people are already doing this.
We set up the event for them to speak.
Yeah.
And it has a life of its own. So they start dreaming each other's dreams. One person will dream of something one night, and uh-huh. the next night someone else will dream of it.
So can you tell us a little bit about this? Tell us some story, no?
Oh, well, okay. I guess I've just been drawing a lot of nightmares over mm-hmm. the last few days. Uh-huh. And there's something about knowing that people have... Everyone walks around as if they're okay in life, mm-hmm. generally. But this, like, dreadful experience of visceral fear uh-huh. had been going through the people in the hotel who were staying there. Uh-huh. One person, she dreamt of a conference where someone spoke down the microphone, "Look, all the animals are dying and there's nothing we can do." Uh-huh. And she was distraught. I mean, like, the picture of uh-huh. the picture of horror. Uh-huh. And all the audience were standing up and just sighing into their microphones like nothing could be said. Uh-huh. So there's some sort of grief that was being articulated there. Mm-hmm. And to get to that level below what everyone wants to be talking about, mm-hmm. it's very tough, it's very powerful. Mm-hmm. And then to connect with that, you know, there's a power and an energy and an alchemical process mm-hmm. in experiencing that fear and speaking that fear mm-hmm. and then coming together. And we keep on creating and we keep on recording dreams and we kind of meld together into mm-hmm. something which becomes a kind of collective dream.
Right.
I think it's a practice of being real, mm-hmm. a practice of speaking intimately, a practice of speaking what you don't know yet. Mm. And in my sense of the moment in time we are at, we need those practices which bring in the creative. Mm-hmm. And we don't know, I don't know, what will bring peace. Mm-hmm. This is what I was thinking on the way here. Yeah. You know, how do we bring peace?
How do we collectively dream peace?
How do we bring up the best dream that we can be dreaming right now?
Yeah.
And I guess this place where I've started with that is just to listen to what are people dreaming uh-huh. and what are they holding?
Right.
And if we can really face that and face that grief, yeah. and face the horrors or face whatever comes in that.
Right.
Do you think collective action, when we know each other more intimately, it always seemed to me that in the 60s and 70s, all the wonderful utopian collectives imploded because they didn't understand things about the unconscious and sexual desire and the shadow, and lots of communes would form who were going to change the world. And then they would shatter because no one could get on with each other. There were egos clashing, you know. Yeah. We couldn't work together.
Yeah.
We couldn't hold it for more than a moment of time.
Yeah. But I wonder whether we are even too late for that. I mean, because the dreams that you were talking about, they seem to me to talk about extinction. And we may be the only species that not only has managed to bring extinction to a lot of animals, but we are in the process very happily to accomplish our own extinction. We may be too late. Peace is a very important thing, but we may be dying peacefully because we have managed to destroy all the... I mean, the planet will be fine, the ones that will not survive, but we are insignificant in the big scale of things. I mean,
I think we have to face that reality mm-hmm. that maybe it is too late, and people are feeling that. They're feeling that intensity of could we even do anything, and the horror of that not being the case.
Right.
But then the story goes on, you know, and there were more dreams in the pot. It was not that one single dream. And I guess what collective dreaming does to me is show that we're all dreaming together If one person has a nightmare, they are not lost because there's a whole collective of other dreamers also inputting. Yeah. And if one person has a vision, it is so, you know, they are not going to lift everyone up with that one vision because somehow we're finding out this mutual creative space.
Right.
I have this hope that we can tell our stories and keep on going deeper into the creative process.
Sounds fantastic. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank
I'm
you
looking
so much.
Forward to see what you come up with. Hi. Nice pyjamas. So, you want to introduce yourself, Matthew?
No.
Yes,
so it's
please
been
do.
Random pyjama wearer of
yes,
Hyde Park.
Yes, random pyjama wearer, fantastic author of a fantastic book on sleep, precisely.
Yeah, so the book is called How to Sleep.
How to Sleep?
It's basically trying to look at aesthetics of sleep. So the normal way in which sleep is understood is in art or in culture generally is as a producer of dreams.
We were just on that question, right?
It's relentless. You know, I think dreams are really overdone. They're far too meaningful, too profound, and I think we need to get down to some much more basic things.
Okay, so tell us what are the basic things that we should get on.
Well,
super fascinated by this. It's like a complete reversal of the previous conversation.
Well, I think, you know, sleep is one of the ways in which humans produce aberrations in their own being, but without consciousness. And so the idea of the book is to look for forms of aesthetics, forms of living without the knowing subject. So to think about the kind of things we do in bed without being awake.
Can I ask you a question? How you came to write this book about the sleep? What's your kind of motivation or moment of...
It's one of the basic practices, one of the basic things that people do. I think everyone's interested in money, everyone's interested in death, everyone's interested in sex, everyone's interested in food, but there's not much reflection on sleep, which is the other thing that everyone does. You know, what can we do if we let go of the preconditions of what sleep is, and look at sleep in the past, look at sleep in other societies, look at sleep as a bearer of aesthetic force, for instance. So if you look at the sleep during Occupy in London in 2011, one of the things which Occupy was contested by the right-wing press was they would go along and look at what was happening in the tents using infrared cameras, saying, there's no one in the tents, and we can prove it. There's actually no one here occupying the city because the tents look empty. The fact that these particular cameras they were using only had a range of 30 meters meant they couldn't see anyone, but still it was seen as evidence of political commitment to be in this space, sleeping in front of St. Paul's.
Right.
So this kind of sense of sleep as a veridiction of a person or a presence of a person or of the truth of a political intent, I think is also very interesting. But that sleep that is there in a way like the bed in of John and Yoko, you know, sleep presenting itself as a political fact of living. And when we take the kind of the intimate moments of life like sleep and so on into these spaces, they can be done in different ways. Like, you know, they can be done in a kind of ostentatious manner, or they can be done to produce new forms of being together, new forms of structuring society and so on.
Thank you.
Okay.
You just heard the artist Catherine Vega and the author Matthew Fuller in bed with Beatrice Colomina at the Serpentine Pavilion Bed Inn. On the topic of dreams, I mean, like, I find that my dreams are usually, like, incredibly banal. It's really disappointing. You know, like, so much of my work is about, like, fantasy and speculative fiction and how we can, like, imagine, like, whatever we want, you know, these, like, fantasy utopias. But actually my dreams, you know, like, I'll be in, like, the grocery store and I'll see somebody I know and I'll ask them, like, if they know where, like, the peanut butter is or something. Like, it's, like, so disappointing. But you know what? I did have, like, this insane dream recently, which I think was, like, an anxiety dream. I was taking care of these two bears. It was like a mother bear and like a baby bear. They kept on like eating, like attacking and eating people's like luxury pets in the neighborhood.
Oh, God.
Like the most like fancy, like you know, Pomeranians and like the most like coiffed, like little like miniature poodles. They just, you know, like they'd be walking down the street with their owners and then these bears would just like snatch one and just like voraciously, like really like gruesomely be like tearing it apart in the back of, I think it was in my parents' house. Oh God.
We're going deep now.
We're going so deep. And people kept on coming by and being like, have you seen my pet? And I'd be like, no.
I won't attempt an analysis of the dream, although there's a lot there.
There is a lot there.
So this morning I woke up and I had been dreaming that I was walking naked through the streets of Paris at night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then a person approached in a van and said something, and I asked them to say it again, assuming sort of straight away this idea of shame.
Yeah.
This, you know, that I was somehow going to be shamed for being naked.
Yeah.
And actually, they were just asking me where the grocery store was.
Oh.
So perhaps we telepathically shared the grocery store dream. But then I was thinking, it occurred to me that dreams do a lot of the emotional labor that we're unwilling or don't have the time or the capacity or even the kind of humility or something to do during awake time.
Yes.
Because this whole dream about, I figured it out straight away. It had to do with the fact that I'd exposed myself emotionally a little bit too much in a few recent things.
Yeah.
And I felt quite ashamed of it.
Oh.
But instead of being able to kind of, in wakeful hours, go, you know what? It's fine. This is me. This is as much as I'm going to expose myself, and it's fine.
Yeah.
I had to retreat into the world of the dream and sort of have this awkward conversation about grocery stores. So it's almost as though we were saying that the brain that dreams, the dreaming brain or the dream itself, is performing labor for our notion of self, like for the us that we recognize during daytime. I've just finished reading a phenomenal book by an anthropologist called Eduardo Cohn, called How Forests Think.
Mm.
And he talks a lot about this relationship between dreams and the future.
Yeah.
And so let's sort of move away from the idea of, say, do dreams predict a future? But if we assume that dreams somehow partake in the building or the construction of the future, then what are they, or what kind of labor are they performing?
Right.
Or how is that possible? How can we make that statement possible somehow?
Yes. And when you said that, I had to think about Ursula Le Guin's The Word for World is Forest, which is about a world of people who value the dreaming world as much or more than reality. And they don't actually have this kind of like reality dreaming world dichotomy. Like both are kind of, you know, interchangeable and equally as important. And they use the dreaming world to advise and solve their problems in the waking world, and vice versa. So, Lucia, very excitingly, I've invited another guest into the studio today.
Ooh.
So I guess, unfortunately, that means I'll be replacing you.
That's okay.
I'm sorry.
I'm not upset at all. I'm not going to dream about it. No, I'm super excited to hear this conversation, actually, so I will just step aside.
So I've invited in Dr. Helga Schmidt. She is a design researcher, designer, curator, and lecturer, and her work focuses on creating space to have new dreams and visions about our perception of time, and she investigates temporal utopias. Just before I invite her in, one of our favorite conversations at Beatriz Colomina's Bed Inn was with Nina Power, and it relates to what I'm going to talk about with Helga.
So maybe you should introduce yourself, because I know. Yeah, so who are you?
Who am I? It's a good question. I'm Nina Power, and I teach philosophy at Roehampton, and I write lots of things about lots of things.
And in this lots of things, is there anything about the bed or work? Or
I guess, well, two things. So I'm working on a project about men at the
men.
Moment. Yeah. And what happens after Me Too, and how we can come to some kind of like reconciliation between men and women as friends or as something else or just as acquaintances. So I don't know. There's a project there which might involve a bed.
Well, they involve a lot of beds, a lot of these Me Too situations, no?
I guess so. But maybe then that's the place we can, reconcile as well sometimes.
Yeah.
And I guess the question of work, I have done a lot of work on work, which is always a paradoxical activity. Yeah, I mean, I think clearly there's a sense in which we have lost our minds. And I think, you know, I was thinking only this morning when I woke up at sort of sunrise that the invention of the sundial was a terrible idea, you mm-hmm. know. And the sundial, what does the sundial do? Well, it divides our day, you know, into hours. And it's actually incorrect, even the early ones. You know, so now we have these kind of blocks of time, you know, which created this kind of anxiety. And this is obviously a very old project, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and whoever invented the sundial, well, there are various people. Maybe it was in, you know, Mesopotamia. You know, clearly there was a desire for measurement, to structure time, whether to give it like an economic dimension, you know, mm-hmm. to kind of hurry people to market, whatever. You know, as opposed to maybe like a more philosophical, peripatetic approach where you might kind of wander around, you know, and lose track of time, yeah. as it were, but maybe also follow how things are going, like by the sun. You could mm-hmm. just look at the sun. You yeah. know, I mean, obviously we can't look at the fucking sun today, but, you know. yeah, I mean, look, even God hides sometimes, you know. And I think one of the interesting things about living in Britain, if we could say that, is actually, and other Northern European countries, is how we cope with the absence of sun, actually. And what this
How did you cope, actually?
Well, that's always a fascinating question to me. How did you manage that?
It's true. I mean, if you don't have any money, the cheapest way, I suppose, is the candle.
The candle.
So, you know, the candle, and it's actually the candle is a lot nicer for you, right, yeah. than electric light. Mm-hmm. And it also has minimal warmth. So, you know, I think there's a kind of maybe question of a certain kind of like pleasurable asceticism. Yeah.
Yeah.
What might it mean, you know, to have just something like, you know, a candle, some leaves, uh-huh. the touch of another person. Oh, indeed, touch. I'm working on touch a lot. Touch is an excellent topic for a bed. What do you think about touch? What's your position?
What kind of position do you think I can have? I'm the interviewer here.
Oh, shit, sorry.
The bed is all about touch, whether you're touching another person or you're touching your mobile phones in our times. It's all about, look at the way in which we touch our cell phone. It's almost like you are stroking a baby, you know, only with a finger like that. You know, they were designed to do that. So it's all about touch.
Yeah, but you know, like the average user of their mobile phone touches it like 5,000 times a day.
Yeah, it's too much.
You know, and how many times do we touch another person?
Less and less, right?
Yeah, it's fucking really depressing.
Yeah.
And everyone's forgotten how, like, touch is also a form of communication, right?
Totally.
You know, usually a nice one. And actually something that kind of, you know, establishes contact and energy.
Right.
And it's fucking free, right? So, right. I mean, work becomes a problem here, actually, because, like, there are all these situations that are maybe awkward. Like, if you touch your colleague on the arm, right? Mm. And then they can't complain about you.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
But it depends on the cultures, right? I mean, one of the things that I have to learn when I went from Spain to the United States, to New York, is the distance that people establish.
Yeah.
And also this thing, because, you know, if you are a Mediterranean person, you touch everybody, right? I mean, you are touching as you are talking.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, in the UK, that's not very well.
That's why people in Britain drink so much.
Yeah. to kind of to drown that feeling.
Well,
but they drink a lot in Spain too. Don't worry.
No, that's true. But they do drink slightly more ecstatically,
and
not, you know, not in this kind of like pathological. And I speak for myself too. Obviously, you know, and I think there's this kind of problem because if you don't touch people, you know, in a light way, often. You know, you do become quite repressed and upset and anxious.
Yes.
And then I think then you need something else to kind of like...
To compensate. Yeah.
Yeah, to compensate, but also to allow you to touch.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If you get drunk and you're like overly friendly or something. But then this is a kind of problem because you lose, you know, the sense of what you're doing.
Right, you know? Right. And then it's when you end up into all these kind of other problems that you were talking about before, the Me Too scenario.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Okay. So you were talking about the sun dial, and I was thinking, is it the sun dial the problem, really? Because the sun dial, it was more like, okay, the sun goes up. Most societies work that way, right?
the sun is up, I start working, right? And but I think the introduction of the clock was a real problem, no? And the and the particular 8-hour schedule of work and of
but they're all related, right?
Yeah,
so you know, I mean, the sundial is the beginning. You know, it's not until you have the railways that you need the timetable. So it's not until that you have a kind of unified clock time,
right?
You know, and there's what's wrong with waking up with the sun and just doing whatever it is you're supposed to be doing. You know, you can like grow some crops and then maybe you can talk about the concept of justice for a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So I'm now joined in the studio by Dr. Helga Schmidt. Welcome.
Hello.
Helga, what did you find interesting about Nina's bed-in conversation?
I think my favorite bit was that it was mainly about the sun and not really talking about clock time in that sense, in my addressing it and probably, yes, our system is built up on this. But the sun given as probably understood as a time giver of something.
Yeah.
You kind of just, as Nina was saying, is you just wake up and, the sun, and then you go out. And sun is really, or day, like natural daylight, is really one of the strongest influence for our body and how...
Yeah, to be active.
Yes, and how you intuitively understand what it does to you and how you feel about it. So I think, we should take the sun more serious in that sense.
Definitely. But then I guess, you know, like the sundial was the precursor for the standard clock that we have.
If you look at them aesthetically, of course, they're really pleasing. But I always try to avoid the clock because I was really not interested because I'm interested in time. And and clocks is one symbol for this kind of social construct.
Yeah.
So I think there's so much better things to look at.
Definitely.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like quite arbitrary that the Earth goes around the sun and that the result of like shadow and light has completely standardized how we go about our lives and how we measure our lives in like days and then years and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think you have the only category we've introduced that's not based on natural rhythms is really the week.
Mm.
And then you had like in the French Revolution, you had this typical thing that they wanted to add it to the decimal system. So you had like 10-day weeks and a day was 10 hours long.
Oh, wow.
So time has always a strong relationship with power, and the same in the Russian Revolution, where they tried to do at least five-day weeks and those kind of things.
Mm.
So people tried to mess around with it.
Yeah.
But I almost think we are... I think we live almost in an old-fashioned system. So it is based on this agricultural system.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, why the seven-day week? Is that based on just like a working week?
That's a religious background. That's why in the French Revolution, they really, because it was against the church, so that's why they wanted to remove it and make it neutral. So that's this kind of decimal system.
Where that's so interesting.
But I think still everything is based on these natural categories and on an agricultural calendar. And if you look at how we work at the moment, we're mostly indoors, so we created a little bubbles. So I almost don't understand why we still don't invent other categories.
Mm. I mean, like you say natural categories, but these are still like always constructed categories, right?
Yeah, and then we start to kind of fragment them into smaller bits.
Mm.
So I think you had it also with sun clocks. I think that was nice when they had the category of an hour, but an hour wasn't, it was really by daylight hours. So you in summer, you have much more daylight hours, and then you split them up by 12. And these hours are very long. And in winter, they're very short.
Oh.
So, you know, an hour wasn't always an hour. A moment once was a category. You know, I think there's a lot of much more to think about and define or redefine in that sense.
Yeah, and how do you define a moment? I mean, maybe this is now where we can talk about your research and, you know, how we can kind of redefine time in terms of a utopian or Uchronian, is that, can you say that?
Yes.
Sense? Can you tell us a little more?
So Uchronia is, in a way, what's utopia for the place is Uchronia for time.
Oh.
So it has the same roots from, like, utopos, Mm-hmm. And Uchronos, so no time. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind is really, why don't we take this kind of freedom that we do with imagining different societies, places, why don't we do the same thing with time? Mm-hmm. And I really tried to open up this idea of Uchronian thinking. So mm-hmm. of like, why are we so linear in our thinking? I'm not suggesting a blueprint for something. I think mm-hmm. that's why I used the refer back to it, to Utopia. But I almost want to, looking into this kind of individualization of like, want you, just if you think about what would be your Uchronian scenario, and it's probably different for everyone. Mm-hmm. So don't limit our, like, not this limitation. This is the one system we have to put on mm-hmm. ourselves. And there's so much more freedom in other categories. That's why I think it's just I often speak also about unlearning time. Mm-hmm. So, because in a way, as children, we deeply embed whatever cultural system we grow up in, this kind of time system we embed.
Yes.
So how do you free yourself? So, you know, we've talked probably now for 5 minutes and mm-hmm. we can feel it almost. It's a tangible thing.
Yeah, so, definitely.
So how do I get you away from this? That's in a way what I'm really interested in.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because I think a lot about how, you know, like things like gender and race are embedded and how we have to kind of like unlearn these things to move towards like a, you know, maybe a utopian society.
Yeah.
And I wonder like how time could figure in this. Like, is it something like Nina Power said, like, you know, like maybe if time didn't exist as it did, like we would just lay in fields and talk about the concept of justice.
I think she really understood the Uchronian idea, I think.
Yeah.
But why not? I think there's so much. I don't know. If you look at it more from a political point of view of like, you don't have, if you're not in this typical model, you have there are no time norms and regulations anymore. Mm-hmm. And who is the one who imposes these deadlines onto mm-hmm. you?
Yeah.
If it's, you know, how much freedom do you have within and how brutal are they?
Yeah.
In the creative world, you probably have more freedom.
Yeah, definitely.
Then it's probably fine. Yeah. It's just if you think you work for a certain company and they push you more and more and more, mm-hmm. and you always think like, oh gosh, I'm too slow, and then you push yourself into a certain degree, then it becomes difficult. And then I really think we really have to think about, can we embed certain time norms that work for deadlines, or how do we categorize this? And that becomes really complicated with all these technological developments. They are faster than law, all these law regulations.
That's really interesting because we've talked in past episodes about kind of like the professionalization of artists. You know, artists going and doing kind of like a 9 to 5, when actually most artists I know are like most productive between the hours of like 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. I myself will kind of like, if it's just like administration or whatever that I need to do, like going in the morning and working until like 6 p.m., 8 p.m., that will work for me. But like actually the best work that I think that I've done has come from a day of lying in bed, and then suddenly, after like watching something or whatever, I'm just like, I need to write something down.
I worked a lot with chronobiologists, mm-hmm. looking into body rhythms, especially the daily rhythm. So it's the circadian rhythm, so circa and dies around a day. Mm-hmm. And I split it up into 7 different phases where you start to understand, and these are pretty much true for everyone, but they have different lengths. So some people need 5 hours of sleep, some 11, sometimes you need 5, you know. Mm. So there's this variation every day. But if you start to understand how you go through the phases and when your concentration is actually best, or your mm-hmm. intuition, and you start to understand to almost relearn these and then work by those instead of squeezing, you know, like everyone, you have a kind of second sleep phase in mm-hmm. after kind of lunchtime.
Yeah.
And then everyone works through with cups of coffee, and you know there's nothing good coming out of this. Why do you force yourself into that grid just because of old-fashioned working hours?
Right.
Instead of like, 3 in the morning is my time and I just accept it. And, you know, so you can think of it from a productivity standpoint of view. I really understand myself. This is my concentration phase and mm-hmm. this is where I'm good in. Or you can just have it more as a real freedom mm-hmm. and introducing a bit of a rhythm rather than almost forcing it into categories. I have to do this from, I don't know, we like to schedule stuff.
Yes.
Even this conversation. So, you know, we could say, oh, it doesn't flow really, and we just stop here. You know what? I need a break.
I need a nap.
I know, you can tell. Or you know, it's really good and we're staying in here and they're already gone, everyone's gone. And we just stay here for 24 hours.
Yeah.
So almost like really like the idea of thinking of different ways of working.
Mm-hmm.
So almost saying meetings are not too long.
Yeah.
We probably should meet for 24 hours, have a team meeting, and then we really know who we can work with or not.
Yeah.
And we have completely different conversations. We are now meeting in a very safe space.
Mm.
This is our professional time. And if we have the conversation at 2 at night, it's probably a very different one. We're in a different stage.
Definitely. I'm not sure if I'd want to have a work meeting.
Want to meet me, dear? No. Thank you.
I'm not sure if I would want to have a 24-hour work meeting.
But that's the challenge.
I guess if it was something that I wanted to do, then maybe. But I guess I'm having trouble imagining it. But I'm interested in this thing that you're saying about like everybody having their own rhythm. And I read a quote that was at the top of one of your writings, which was about how through school, children learn how to wake up very early and kind of like fall into these very like rigid work time categories and like methods of like punctuality that are like socialized as like, you know, being like correct and acceptable.
So I think it's interesting. Punctuality is almost started. So we still squeeze our children into certain, like learning certain patterns.
Mm-hmm.
But you have it, I think, if you just look at the mobile phone, it starts to dissolve a bit. So time is a synchronization device. So somehow we want to meet somehow, somewhere. But if you think about your phone, so you use it probably more in a private area where you're like, let's meet today. And then it goes back and forth. And it's not about the time anymore. It's just the instant communication. And at some point you will meet.
Yes.
So you see already it starts to dissolve the punctuality.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't really found a different synchronization system that would work and that would allow more more a fluent process, fluent and more natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this one project I'm working on the circadian space, talks about different ways of synchronization, almost like building a space that's based on your body rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of this as a small experiment or like a large-scale city experiment. Because if at the moment, how you move through space, this is related to time.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably have an alarm clock, wakes you up, you go from the bedroom to the bathroom, kitchen. At some point, you have to leave the house.
Mm-hmm.
Then you commute, and then you go for lunch. So it's all based on the clock. So what would happen if it's based on your body rhythm?
Mm-hmm.
So you wake up whenever you naturally wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get into wake-up space.
Mm-hmm.
This is where your body unfolds from lying to standing.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the rooms is really adjusted to these different stages.
Mm-hmm.
You would just meet these people who are in these different spaces. So your clock time wouldn't be as important. But then you have to start to also shift, almost a shift in value system of how much do you want to squeeze into your day?
Mm.
Because why do we schedule so much? Has to do with like efficiency thinking.
Yeah.
And are you okay? Or does it work out that you probably meet less people?
Yeah.
Or, you know,
yeah.
What's your working pattern? So I think it has to start with, it's a nice way of thinking like the vita contemplativa and the vita activa.
Mm-hmm.
What do we value in our society? Is it the active life? Or is it more the one that's based on, yes, I'm waking up, laying in the sun and contemplate, which has to do with deep thinking, not just like hanging around and watching Netflix, I guess. I don't know, maybe that's contemplate. I'm sorry, I completely ruined this Ukrainian world now.
Netflix ruined the Ukrainian world.
Wow. No, I'm not giving up yet. In my teaching at the RCA, I do one thing. I run Uchronia workshops with students. So as a kind of method, how can you start thinking it anew?
Mm-hmm.
So I remove them from all time-giving devices.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to think about a time-giver. A time-giver can be the sun, it can be your cat, it can be a technological device, whatever they like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I send them to experimental spaces for 48 to 72 hours to really test this out.
Oh, wow.
And then I kind of wake them up. And it's, for me, about, because time is an experience you have to have.
Yeah.
And during that period, I want them to understand that they can build their own time community. Uh-huh. And whatever rules they make up within this community, that works as their time-giving systems.
That's wonderful. So where do you send them?
Very different. So I think I had one group, they wanted to read out loud Proust for 48 hours.
Oh, God.
they have to decide themselves what they do. I don't torture them. So well, one was reading, one person was knitting, one was making notes, and one person was allowed to sleep. Mm. And then they go through the rhythm, and they really enjoyed it. They didn't even know each other. But the book really became their time giver, and they lived in this world.
Wow.
And then I wake them up, and afterwards they don't even want their phones back and things. Because it's more about what it changed with their thinking. And then I interview them right after, 1, 2, 3 years later, if it really has an impact of exploring that freedom.
That's so interesting. I think I might challenge myself to do a similar experiment. Probably not with Proust.
And, no. Maybe it's too literal.
Yeah. I'll just try and stay away from the Netflix as well. This has been a great conversation of how many minutes, we don't know.
You don't care.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Give your body up for abstraction. Bite your tongue and eat it. This is a corrective therapy. Now into one alienating and alienating. Now into the meat of the world. Don't speak to me in obscurities, recreation, stripped down. Carry nothing but light, only light. No longer clutch to guaranteed space, but recreate space, temporalize space, the universe as adapting space, a love that gives space, a love that is space, tactile, palatating, and self-immolating, to become the room. Now let the silence undo you. Now release into the morning light. Now in your own loving words, no to the fragility of language, no to the ego, no to the colonial context of thought, no to fake tenderness, no to liberation without destruction, no to self-destruction, no to masters. Life rubs up matter against matter, inner core against inner core. Try not to be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. The light washes the body clean, lay throbbing in the sky to live affixed to the circuitry of the world. The body is pinned to the sky in blue, reborn in this energy, caught and released, lucidage and tangibility, realities of dust. The sky sweeps it all away. Regulate the unconscious play of the mind. Have you ever seen pink moonlight? It's frightening.
That was Sky Song by Precious Okoyomon, a poet and artist from New York City. Oh, by the way, I'm back.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you. So, Precious, it was late at the work marathon.
Yes, I missed this.
It was beautiful.
Oh.
And, you know, everybody's getting tired. We've heard an entire day full of talks and all kinds of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
5 different things happening at once across 2 campuses. It was complex.
Everybody is exhausted at this point, usually.
At this point, everybody's sort of not wanting to work anymore, right? Particularly the production crew, including myself. And the lights dim, and Precious walks in, and they fold themselves onto a big cushion and starts to read this most beautiful poetry work.
Mm.
And we all just...
Wow.
Like held our breath for about 10 minutes.
That sounds wonderful.
It was so beautiful. And it had a similar effect that I guess jumping into bed earlier on in the day may have had.
Nice.
This kind of break.
Like a bedtime story or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or a song, or like just a break in the fabric of the reality of like a live event.
Yes.
The Serpentine Podcast. On Work.
Thank you for listening to episode 6 of the Serpentine Podcast on Work. I've been your host, Victoria Sin. You can listen to the whole series at radio.serpentinegalleries.org or subscribe with your podcast provider. The Serpentine podcast on work is curated by Lucia Pietro-Justi and Kay Watson. We were produced by Jesse Lawson and Jack Howson from Reduced Listening, with sound design by Dane Law. And here is Precious Okoyemon with Resurrection Song.
Resurrection Song, buried life, frenzied sun, carry my colors to the forest, let it all be done, object well formed, a parable, circle me forever, turn to smile, yellow shimmers. I can't remember my dreams, so I really don't exist. The body is submerged in the command, jamming the tongue back to swallow it, but I am only a body of water, nourished by the wind. At the end of the dream, I found myself unlacing the monsters, night sprouts from our self-denial. The umbilical cord returned back into its ephemeral splendor. Everyone just wants the bread and the wine and the body. I am aware of my present poverty, recklessly descending on carcasses, perched in a moment, paws full of flesh. I lay my skin out to dry, beams of shadow, the glossy fash, a maddening buzz. At the end of the dream, I was tormented by the jerky orgasms of the hysterical life. Time passes very quickly, I feel like a cyclone. Life bursts like an overripe pomegranate, a whole day, endless work. Cooking, cleaning sprees, endless jitters. I never have enough. It's never enough. Always running short, getting bored, keeping up appearances. Try and make more room for laughter. I whisper my secrets, only talk of loving, a cacophony of plucky singers. My body turns a bouquet of singing, and you are cozy. You eat good. You drink good. There are puddings and fig wines. We're too entwined, tasting of wild rosemary, vinegar, sugar, cayenne, and the liquid of suns. These are good things which you drive. They are wild, and I distill them to the point of ecstasy. You cocoon inside of me. With fragrances, you laugh. I sing. The notes flare on like cocoon palms. Hallelujah. Praise on, hallelujah, the mouth sings, the ass, the feet, the hands, the cunt. Your entire being liquefies into sound, the voices, the rhythm. Meet me inside of the chrysalis. At the peak of the ascent, I burst like a cloud, the juice runs down your mouth, the sky songs don't stop, but I roll on anxious, heavy, trekking through the valleys of fear, the tunnels of anguish and the fires of hell. Each one starts pulling, the devil's tail is in my mouth, fear pierces me. I doze into my daydream with rose petal eyelids, the day comes. Soft and velvety upon my tongue, feathers falling from the sky and red pussy sunsets. This is the desire of the drill of power. The sky is set with a statue of protest. The feet, they're drowning things. The soil is perched. I am pretty, hushed up, and scandalous. Please amend the hatred of the narrow thinking of my mind. At the end of the daydream, I am frustrated with my bed, with I am frustrated on the bed with my ass in the air. I know how to dispose of my aborted dreams. The boredom falls equally on all things, the stagnant, unbroken brightness. Oh, I see a hummingbird. Sorcery lulls me into melancholy tenderness. My anger laps up with flames. I was awakened by the night. Ah, this is the disgrace, a colonial highway, winds plucked and brown. The twigs fly up into smoke. My whole entire race lays dried banana leaves, rags, yearning like a fat cockroach. Everyone's desire goes astray, for this is a sea of garbage. The sea opens up into a foaming rage, for this is a pile of rotting muck. I compare my lust for a foolish forest. I wish it was in my power to show you. I declare my sins, for there is nothing to say in my defense. Dance idols, for I am too an apostolate. I have assigned God with my laziness, my words, my obscene gestures. I slow. Swallow a gallop of hummingbirds straight into the earth's breast. From staring too long at trees, I have become a tree. Now my feet are in the ground. Shh. My feet have dug into the ground, for I am venomous. I go where the water goes, for this is a madness of remembering. This is a madness. Do you know the rest? At the beginning, I choke on the feathers of hummingbirds, angels guarding the goats, gates of foam. I have exhausted memories, patience, defied, tired. I worship my perversity. It overwhelms me. Oh, what impenetrable jungle. Oh, what horrible leaps. Vroom, vroom, vroom. I charm the snakes. Vroom, vroom, vroom. I turn the rain back into waves. Vroom, vroom, vroom. Effort just to stay alive. Vroom, vroom, vroom. The promised times will never return. A cursed venereal sun pecked out by hummingbirds. Eternally renewed cross. I lay in my grave of animality. Legs parted, standing stiff, fear in the back of my throat, fear in the trees, fear in the ground, piled up in anguish. May the stars find my confidence, stuffing my throat with fangs, for this is the end of the world. Begin again. Mourning in forgetfulness, rotting in the sun's overhead pulse. Oh, love of the world, I hate you. Resting in vanity, bathe me in blood, emptied of anger, recoil and expand. The body convulses and resounds. It's all about perspective. Standing in the midnight sun, rise, sky liquor, rise. 4 minutes and 33 seconds. I had an unhappy act the other day. I went to go see a white man about my mental health. I get it. I'm here. I'm not really here. What does it matter? Spells burning away emotion, detorn the innocence. The only thing I can control are my emotions if I try hard enough. Shifting flames resist the living body. It is necessary to uproot oneself, to cut down the tree and make it a cross, and then to carry it every day. What mind denies its history, floating on present breath, take me back to where I belong. A wound, a womb, a void. I keep forgetting I am the void. LOL. If you think you took something from me, I'm flattered and you can have it. I will be waiting in blackened faith. The skin stays, the organs move. A wall inside of myself speaks. Extraordinary teeth looking for fuckable orifices. A new language of my twisted heart's transparency. I am afraid things are getting fuzzy now. A low-res simulation. I wanted to kill but had nothing to kill but myself. I know what I want and I swear to you I'm gonna get it. Insert affirming blackness, insert affirming queerness. Ah yes, the tedium. What is more frightful than to die in a nightmare? Lay down there, fill it with red, orange, and green. I put the earth in my mouth. Sustainable thoughts only. I plant myself in myself. The hungriest woman in the world is obviously me. Duh. I can take everything you're coming at me with. To accept the void in ourselves is supernatural. I became a mystic to kill what hides. A violent distance of myself, I am capable of imagining what I fear and laying it to rest. The suppression of knowledge, the suppression of self. Hacked from light, I'm taking you with me. Galvanized spirits, we have nothing to lose. Pre-sky, emit light, yes, like that. Everything wants to kill you, and you should be afraid. Radical modernity required something from me. Whiteness requires something from me. The world requires something from me. I'm looking for a place to lie down. I tilt the sky until all I can see are the clouds, black and thick. No ownership, no requirements.